Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss, and welcome to episode number 9 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart business owners with an interest in innovation and the Internet of Things become even more innovative. I can't believe we're already at episode number 9. There you go. We've got nine weeks since we began the InnovaBuzz podcast. Now, today's guest is Alan Barton of Lehigh Technologies. And I'm really excited to have Alan on the podcast today because I worked with Alan back in the days when we were both at Roman Haas. So I know him from those days, and I'm really excited to see what he's been up to since he's been at Lehigh Technologies. Now, Lehigh Technologies take old scrap rubber and turn it into a recycled rubber product that adds value to the applications where it finds use in. So not only does it add value, it improves the properties of the products where it's used and also enables cost reduction. So it really is an exciting development. Now, there's lots of fantastic lessons in today's interview. Alan talks a lot about innovation and managing innovation in a startup company. The technology that Lehigh have developed in order to build the company, build the platform, and develop the products that are the basis of their business model, and how they continue to differentiate themselves in a marketplace where a lot of people are in fact doing recycling of various products. Now, Alan talks about the need to manage a team and get the right expertise in place in that startup to manage an expansion in concert with sales. So don't just build capacity before you actually have the sales in place to be able to support that capacity. And he also talks about taking calculated risks in order to innovate. Now, this is another fascinating interview with a lot of insights, and I'm really excited to present this to you today. So stay tuned for something really great. Today's innovation tip is welcome failure. That's right. There's no such thing as what people commonly refer to as failure. In fact, it's just feedback on the road to success. To be innovative, organizations need to develop the freedom to experiment, to succeed, and hence to fail from time to time. In other words, to gather that feedback on the road to success. Now, of course, that doesn't mean to say that you should be taking reckless risks or making mistakes that other people have already made or repeating the same mistakes over and over again. It means being smart about it, being strategic, taking experiments to find out how things will work out and be prepared to take risks and to fail. Now, it's very important to be strategic in taking those experiments and taking the risk of failure, but the important thing to focus on is not what you have to lose, but what you have to gain. So be prepared to fail on the road to success. Now, quick competition announcement today. Today's competition is sponsored by InnovaBiz, where we help smart businesses that are looking to get the most out of their presence online, and we help them turn that online presence into a business generation machine that works even when they're not working. The prize for today's competition is a copy of the book Cradle to Cradle by William McDonough and Michael Braungart, and this is all about using end-of-life materials to create a new product. Now, stick around for details on how to enter that competition later on in today's interview. So, without further ado, let's meet Alan. Let's go to the Innovation Hive and get the buzz from Alan Barton.
This is the InnovaBuzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm very pleased to have here with me, all the way from Philadelphia in the USA, Alan Barton. Now, Alan is the Chief Executive Officer of Lehigh Technologies. Welcome, Alan, to the Innova Buzz podcast.
Thanks, Jürgen.
Now, Lehigh Technologies take recycled rubber and basically make micronized rubber powder from that. And those micronized rubber powders then go into a variety of applications that deliver savings in both energy and production cost, and also reduce waste and improve performance. But we'll hear more about that from Alan later on. Now, Alan also serves on the board of a number of companies, including Renmatics, I think, Technitrol, and Wilbur Ellis Company. So I'm really looking forward to Alan sharing his insights with us today, because he does have an enormous variety of experience. And of course, I know Alan from having worked with him in the days when I was with Roman Haas. Now, before we learn more about Alan and about Lehigh, a quick competition announcement. Today, I'm going to give away a copy of Cradle to Cradle by William McDonough and Michael Braungart. And that book explains how products can be designed from the outset so that after their useful lives, they will provide nourishment for something new. So continually circulating as pure and viable materials with a cradle-to-cradle model. So stick around for details on how you can enter the draw to win that later on in the interview. So, Alan, before we learn about Lehigh Technologies and the innovative stuff you're doing there, let's find out a little bit about you. Take you back to when you were a young child. What did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, about 1,000 years ago, something like that. When I was a real little kid, I was crazy about planes.
Okay.
And all I wanted to do was be a pilot.
Yeah.
And then sort of by the time I got into high school, that's when reality set in, I think. And my goal was to be a nuclear physicist at that point.
Okay.
Needless to say, neither of those two career choices actually happened.
Yeah. So when did you... Yeah, it's funny, actually. I was listening to some podcasts yesterday, two different ones, and both people said they wanted to be pilots when they were young. So it seems to be a common dream of young children. When did you change direction and go into chemistry?
Well, in high school, I was sort of fascinated by both physics and chemistry, and the fact that my math probably wasn't up to snuff to the extent that it needed to be, sort of pointed me in that direction. And I must say, haven't regretted it since.
Yeah. And so once, so you had a really great career early on. You went to Oxford, if I remember correctly, and then to Harvard to do your PhD.
Yep.
And from there, did you go straight to Roman Haas from there?
I did, yeah. Once I left with my PhD from Harvard, I was looking to stay in the US and go into the field of synthetic organic chemistry, and Roman Haas was great enough to offer me a job. And so I moved down from Boston to Philly and started my career there.
Mm-hmm. And you've been in Philadelphia ever since?
With 6 years out in Germany with Roman Haas in between. Where my kids were born. Okay. Yeah, it's basically been in the Philly area for all that time.
Okay, and I think it was in while you were in Germany that we met.
It was, yep, it was.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about Lehigh Technologies now.
Well, so as you mentioned, the company was founded on the idea that there had to be something better to do with old tires or old rubber waste than just burning them, shredding them and burning them, or burying them, and so on and so forth. And so the founders of the company believed that if you could turn that end-of-life tire material into micron-scale powders, that that would open up a bunch of different opportunities that would be higher value than those typical sort of alternate recycling type markets. And so they founded the company in the early 2000s, I think around 2003, with that notion. And they spent a few years researching the types of technology that you would need to be able to turn those chunks of rubber into those very, very fine powders, settled on a particular type of technology out of Germany, acquired the company, and started to build the manufacturing plant. I joined in 2008 after they had raised a significant amount of money from well-known investors like Kleiner Perkins and so on. to sort of move the company to the next stage, which is how do you then really commercialize those materials into the type of specialty chemicals and use markets that we're in today. So that's how I got involved, and that's where the company started. And really, we've been commercial. The plant started manufacturing materials at scale in 2007, and that was when the first sales were. And then since 2008, we've really seen tremendous growth, even though that's been during some of the tougher economic times around the world. We've been successful at growing between 30 and 40% every year since then.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. So I was reading some statistics about the use of rubber tires and where they end up, and it's pretty staggering. And I think these might be actually understated, because they're from back in 2008 or so. They're talking about 240 million tires in the USA alone that are thrown away, and fewer than 7% being recycled. So there's a huge opportunity there to actually do something with all that material, isn't there?
Exactly. If you can use almost the guide that for the sort of Western democracy, so industrialized economies, one tire per person per year is thrown away. That works for Japan, it works for the European Union, it works for the US. And then these days, about half of those discarded tires are burned for their fuel value. Right? So better than burying them or leaving them lying around on the edge of town, but hardly a beneficial use, hardly something to be proud of, given all of the technology and the chemistry that's been put into that material in the first place.
That's right, yeah.
So a huge opportunity, just like you said.
So you've got a production facility in or near Georgia in Atlanta, right? In Georgia, near Atlanta. So tell us a little bit about that and the technology, because I believe that's the biggest of its type in the world.
It is. As I mentioned earlier, the milling system is a proprietary system. It's covered by a bunch of patents. And in fact, Lehigh early on bought out the small German manufacturer that produced those materials, those mills. So we're really the only ones that have this technology. And fundamentally, the process is cool the rubber infeed down with liquid nitrogen so that it's way, way below its TG. Then at least you have something brittle that can be pulverized. The type of mill this is an impact mill. So imagine that frozen piece of glass-like rubber being introduced to a jet turbine. So you have large vanes whizzing around at 2,500 RPM. Into that comes cryogenically frozen rubber with a bunch of liquid nitrogen with it. It impacts the vanes immediately, shatters into a complete particle size distribution, and within milliseconds, the expanding gas has blown it out the other end of the system. And so it's then warmed up carefully so that you can separate it out into different particle size distribution components and then packaged in various systems after that. So the thing that's neat about this system, first of all, because it's cryogenic, it's very gentle on the polymers, right? If you want to use that chemistry again, you don't want to basically destroy it first. So it's very gentle on the polymers. The scale of it is such that we can produce thousands of pounds an hour. So it can produce industrial scale quantities, which is what you need to do if you're going to be servicing construction industries or the tire industry. And the particle size distribution is skewed to the very, very small. And one of the keys to the use in those applications is the amount of surface area that you have. So therefore, this type of system is well, well designed for what we're trying to do. And so, yeah, we have six production lines. The capacity is right around 70,000 tons per year. We're not using that much, of course, at this point, but growing at the rate we are, you can see that we'll be bumping up against that in the not too distant future.
Okay. And tell us about some of the end use applications that product then finds its way into.
Tires is our largest market. So you can imagine the notion of putting this material back into tires is perfectly logical. It's taken us a long time to figure out how to use it in tires. In other words, how to optimize those compounds, those formulations, to get exactly the right performance. For somebody with your background, just think of how one has to optimize the use of opaque polymer in paints, right?
Same notion.
So that's our largest market. And to give you a sense of how broadly we've been able to introduce it, over 250 million tires have been manufactured using our products since we started really producing at scale in 2007 and early 2008. So tires is our largest market. Industrial rubber is another obvious one. Asphalt modification is another significant market for us. Some material of, like that is used in Australia and a couple of other Asian countries, where the rubber is put in there not only to reduce cost, but to improve some of the performance properties. So hot, high temperature rutting, cold temperature cracking, things like that. So that's an important use for us. Construction applications, sealers for parking lots, waterproofing systems for the building envelope, cladding for roofs to help improve water resistance and things like that are just some examples of markets that we're currently commercial in.
Okay, so that's a pretty wide gamut there of applications, and I'm sure you're discovering new ones all the time as well.
That's the plan.
Yeah. I noticed you've recently, or I don't know, was it recently, probably a few years ago, set up an applications development center there as well. And I guess their one of their roles would be to optimize those formulations, as you mentioned.
Exactly. You know, we're unique in this market in that we have basically adopted the positioning as a specialty chemical supplier, right? We're effectively producing an additive that can be used in a wide range of systems with a set of performance attributes. It just so happens that the raw material for it is an end-of-use material. But other than that, we look, sound, smell, and feel like a specialty chemical company.
Okay. So how do you describe what you do in one sentence, then, if you meet somebody for the first time and they say, what is it you do, Alan?
You mean for the company?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we basically take waste end-of-life rubber, turn it into a micron scale powder that can be used in a wide range of different specialty chemical end uses in your everyday life. Materials that you see all around you every day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I like that. That's understandable to everybody.
Exactly.
Really good. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Now, certainly you mentioned a little bit about the innovation in production that you use, and I've heard you describe that on a video, I think it was, as a jet engine with teeth, and you talked a little bit about how that worked. Tell us a little bit, because the other thing I noticed was, or I read about, was this closed-loop business model that I think was talked about on your website. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, in fact, the guys that wrote the book that you're going to give away are very fond of the whole closed loop model for maximum, not only resource efficiency, but sustainability as well. So several parts of the rubber world produce significant amounts of processed scrap. So as an example, when a retread is manufactured, it's made in a very large band of tread stock, and there's quite a lot of processed scrap that comes with that. In the past, that material was simply landfilled. So here you have virgin, high-cost, high-performance rubber being basically discarded. So over the past years, we've worked with these companies to take that process scrap. We do the primary shredding, and then we turn it into micronized rubber powder, and we've worked with them to optimize those retread formulations to be able to use it back in their own system. So for those guys now, think of it in terms of a quality assurance point of view. They've got exactly the same chemical compound that they started with. We segregate all that material so they only get their powder back.
Okay.
It's a particle size distribution that's optimized for their formulation and only for their formulation. And there's zero waste and they save money. What's not to like about that?
Yeah, it's a win-win-win.
And so it is sort of, you know, it hits all the buttons. And we therefore have very tight relationships with those guys, and so from a competitive advantage point of view, it's a very sticky value proposition as well.
Yeah, that's really exciting stuff. And yep. like you say, it gives you the ability to partner very closely with your customer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And add huge value.
Yep.
So there's gold in that in terms of a model to work with.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, exactly. And we're trying to expand that now into some other rubber chemistries, like butyl rubber, which is a very high cost rubber that's used for inner liners and things like that in tires. And also for EPDM, which of course is used a lot in automotive for waterproofing and sealing as well.
Okay, and I noticed also you've just recently secured some funding to expand in, I believe you're looking to expand production in Europe?
Yes. Yeah, in fact, we just completed our latest raise in the middle of the summer with our existing investors coming in with money, as well as JSR, a well-known supplier of SBRs based in Japan, joined as a strategic investor in that round as well. Which is excellent to have that sort of validation from a leader in SBR technology supporting what we're doing. Yeah, so those funds will be used primarily for geographic expansion. We are in the process of putting together a joint venture in Europe, which will lead to local manufacturing early next year. And that'll be our first production line outside of the US.
Mm-hmm.
Coming after that, at some point, will be a production line in Asia. We're already exporting quite a bit of material to Asia every month. And so at some point it makes sense to have a local manufacturing site. And we're currently sort of looking at where that might be and what sort of size and scale and cost profile it could have.
Hmm. Yeah, that's exciting stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. So what do you spend most of your time doing on a day-to-day basis?
Great question. Probably about a third of my time is focused on sales type activities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our sales force is very small. There's only 5 people in that, including me. And so I'm spending a fair amount of time with customers. I'm the chief sales guy for Europe, so I'm traveling over there pretty frequently with our JV partner. So about a third on commercial activities, about a third on manufacturing. So think of that as cost reduction, productivity, capacity planning, all of the stuff that goes with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously as we scale, a lot of this equipment is being pushed to limits that it, you know, wasn't intended for maybe at the beginning or designed for. So we've got a lot of work to do on debottlenecking. And about a third of my activities are on sort of what you would call internal. So board of directors stuff, investor stuff, outreach with investment bankers, things like that, and so on. So roughly a third, a third, a third, and that adds up to about 8 days in a week.
Yeah, I think that's the case for most people in business.
Exactly.
So do you worry about anything? Is there something that keeps you awake at night?
Lots of things. And in fact, if anything, you know, in the startup world, there's even more things to worry you than there are in a more established company.
Mm.
Because you're so thin, you know, you don't have a lot of resources. So you don't have a lot of people to do all that worrying for you. So the things that keep me up at night, any manufacturing facility, especially one that's sort of chemically oriented, safety is a very important part of what we do. And as this process is new, as our people are learning things, you know, we don't have a whole bunch of history on this like we would have done at Roman Haas.
Hmm.
So safety, both of the process and our people, is key. And that certainly worries me all the time. I think the second one is constantly having the ability to grow our business. I mentioned we've done quite well in growing every year so far. That means you constantly have to be looking out at your sales pipeline, you know, 12, 18, 24 months ahead, so that you know you've got a pipeline that will deliver for you moving forward, right? You can't look backwards, you've got to look forwards. And then the third one is having the talent that we need. You know, we are very lean, every single position has got to contribute. You know, everybody's wearing at least 2 hats. And we've got to be looking at, you know, who are the next 1 or 2 people that we're going to bring on, whether it's in the R&D group, whether it's in the commercial group, and sort of thinking ahead and make sure you might make the right decisions there. So those are probably the things that I would spend the most time worrying about in the last couple of hours with a scotch before I go to sleep.
Okay. So I guess that helps
yes.
get to sleep then later on.
Yeah. Exactly.
So how many employees do you have at Lehigh?
We got about 77 at the moment.
Okay.
And over 50 of those, between 50 and 60 at any one time, are in the production area. And then the rest are salaried, if you like, divided up across the normal range of functions. But we're all in this, aside from the commercial people who work out of their homes, you know, wherever they happen to be based, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest of us are here in this one site, just outside of Atlanta.
Okay. So you mentioned some things that you worry about. What do you see as the biggest challenge in building an organization like Lehigh that's kind of at the leading edge of a specialty chemical application?
That's a really interesting question, right? From a sort of people point of view, because in the end, it's the people that are going to do this. And we're always looking for people that have got this combination of experience in the industries that we're serving. You've got to have that, otherwise you don't have the credibility to be able to stand in front of them. They've got to be technically trained and have a technical background, and preferably have worked in this type of chemical industry type environment before. And yet they've got to be willing to leave all that behind and take on a high-risk job in a high-risk company. So it's an interesting set of mixture of competencies and aptitudes that we're looking for that it's not easy to find. And if anything, that's probably been the biggest challenge as we've staffed up over the past few years, is finding that combination.
Okay.
And I think that's just going to get more difficult as we start to expand now outside of the US into Europe and into Asia, because that's even riskier because we're only just getting our feet on the ground.
And it does get you back into what you certainly have a lot of experience with, which is managing remote teams and diverse yep. cultures and locations and all the challenges with legislation that's different in different locations and so on.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, this year I've probably just completed my sixth trip to Europe as we get all that moving. And by December, I will have been in Asia five times this year. So it's very much like Back to the Future. You know? It's like yeah. it's like the old days.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Where's your office? It's in an aircraft or an airline
exactly.
lounge. Yeah.
But you got to do that, right? I mean, half the plan of winning a sale is being there, is showing up. And email and phone calls only take you so far. You got to be there.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads me on, and I was going to ask about the internet and how you use that. Basically, you know, first of all, when did you discover the web?
You mean myself or for the company?
Yourself.
Yeah. It was sort of, you know, I mean, if you think about this, the first time that we started to use the internet was probably in a work environment in the 90s for Roman Haas, probably the late 90s, really, because we were a bit slow in the uptake of Roman Haas. So it was probably around the late 90s. And then by the time you and I were working in Coatings and we were just starting to think about online activities, that was in the mid-2000s, sort of 2005, 2006. Well, maybe a bit before that, maybe the turn of the 2000s, right, around that time. So that's really the first time that I got serious about it.
So do you
was
see...
just around that time.
Yeah. So do you see opportunities there for example, you know, easing that travel load on people to make more use of the web and the technologies, because it's certainly changing at an enormous pace, isn't it?
Yeah, we do use quite a lot of either Skype or even Facebook chat or FaceTime. You know, the ability on your mobile now, if somebody's on FaceTime, to just click it and you're standing there on your cell phone talking to them is fantastic, as long as the language barrier is not too difficult.
Yeah.
Skype we use as well. I'm a bigger fan of both of those than I am of formal video conferencing, because that's just more complicated to set up, and you know, it has to be a more formal meeting type environment. And so on the communication side, I think that's ideal for us, being a small company. On the sort of interacting with our potential customers, our website is our main tool. And we've revamped that basically every 2 years just to keep it current and to make sure the message that we want to send is the right one and it's aligned with our strategies. And I must say that the traffic that we get from the internet, from people finding us, is very, very good. If anything, it's perhaps a bit more than we can handle. And then secondary tools for us, we use Facebook a little bit on the social media side, more as just a chatty, personal type of interaction with people. We don't use Twitter. So those are the main things that, that we do and why we do them.
Okay, that's fascinating, yeah. So are there any other sort of innovative ways to use the internet that you're looking at?
There aren't at the moment, but one of the things that's sort of in our future, we think, is remote control of manufacturing. We do have the ability, in fact, we have a camera system in our plant that allows us to record everything that's going on all the time. And when you connect that up with the HMI or the process control system that we use, you've got a very powerful combination of tools. Both of those can be used over the web.
Okay.
When we open the plant in Spain, it will be connected via the internet, actually via the cloud, to our system here. So we will, if we wanted to, we could actually control and turn knobs and make things happen from here. But it'll be more an engineering tool for our chemical engineers to share information and accelerate learning, if you like, as they get up and running.
Yeah, that's a fascinating one. I mean, there's a lot of online learning opportunities there for the internet, and certainly, like you mentioned, to use real data and real case studies,
exactly,
if you like, to actually generate the information for that learning is really good. All right. Now, we've talked a lot about Lehigh and about what sort of keeps you up awake at night and so on. How do you keep balanced? What do you do when you're not working?
Well, when people ask me, well, what about work-life balance? I ask them what it is. But there is a little bit of time. I mean, I have plenty of time on an airplane. I really enjoy reading.
Yeah.
Both fiction as well as non-fiction. So that's actually one of the things that helps keep me sane. And then I've always done photography as well, just like you do.
Yeah.
But that's really restricted to just sort of almost one photo trip a year.
Okay.
And then it takes me about the rest of the year to then develop those negatives and print them and get them the way I want them. So, in the future, that'll change. And hopefully the balance will slip the other way once I retire.
Yeah. So you're one of the few people that I know that still works with film. And I believe
absolutely
you used to do large format camera shots as well.
I still do.
Yeah, still
yep,
do.
I still do. Yep, 8x10 and 11x14 black and white.
Okay, fabulous. So have you read any interesting books recently that you could recommend to our audience?
I think there's several. For fun, this whole sort of Nordic crime genre has become very popular. You know, so the girl with the dragon tattoo type stuff. Joe Nesbo is a younger version of the guy that wrote those.
Okay.
And it's very dark and very Swedish and Finnish type, you know, thing. So that's kind of fun. And then I'm also reading a fair amount of history now of England in the 50s and 60s. So sort of around the time that I was born, right, and starting to be cognizant of what was happening around me, that's pretty fascinating as well.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. So if you had a magic wand that you could wave and fix one thing in Lehigh, what would it be?
I'd lower the cost.
Lower the cost of...
I take 5 cents out of our manufacturing cost.
Okay. So that's a big challenge then, is it?
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you think about, again, think back to our old days, our goal was to really drive unit costs down every single year. And we've been successful at doing that. But as you're learning the process as it grows and you're learning how to make more product with the same assets, right, it's hard to be have a singular focus on that and make as much progress as you'd like.
So what's the biggest component of the manufacturing cost there? Is it energy or is it?
I think there's two major ones. One obviously is nitrogen. That's a key input that we use. And then the second one is raw material. And whether that's material that we acquire ourselves and shred or whether it's stuff that we buy, you know, it's managing that complex mixture of raw materials and making sure that we can get them at a good cost.
Okay. That's fascinating. I would have thought maybe energy might be a big chunk there.
It is in a way, because energy is the major constituent of the cost of liquid nitrogen, right? So in a way, that is what we're buying.
Okay. So you've mentioned the expansion plan. So and the future plans for Asia as well. So they're obviously the key things that you're currently working on.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we're currently selling to Europe at the moment. We actually bring raw material from Europe to Atlanta, make micronized rubber powder here and ship it back so that we reach compliant. And so the quicker we stop doing that and the quicker we make it locally, the better off we'll be.
Yeah.
As I said, we are selling into Asia now quite a lot. And so it's really setting about what is the timing to start that project, because we'll have volume to put in there straight away as soon as the plant is running. And then we can handle Latin America by export for a little while longer.
Yeah, well, that's a great position to be in, to have the sales online already before you set up a facility.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to what I call the buzz, which is our innovation round. So it's about five or six or seven questions that hopefully we'll get a very short answer from you that'll blow the audience away with your insight. So what do you think is the number one thing people need to do to be more innovative?
I think it's to embrace risk. You know, so much innovation is stifled because people fear making mistakes, or their bosses don't like people making mistakes, or the culture is to avoid making mistakes. But you can't innovate if you don't make mistakes, if you don't go down blind alleys, if you don't try things that don't work. So embrace risk, make mistakes, enjoy them, learn from them, move on.
Yeah. That's great advice. Yeah. What do you see as the risk of innovation? The what you could perhaps guard against when you take that path?
Give it a fair amount of thought first. Rule out the really stupid mistakes, and concentrate on making mistakes that you can learn from.
Yeah. Try to avoid the mistakes that somebody else has already made as well.
Yeah, right. Let somebody else do the stupid ones, and then you just do the targeted ones.
Yeah, great. What's the best thing that you've done to develop new ideas?
I think listen to as many different people as you can. Whether that's people that are trying to do what you're doing now, they might have done it before and it didn't work. People that are in industries that supply you, people that are in industries that are maybe a replacement product for yours, your customers, your employees, listen. Ask a billion questions, listen, and try and join all those dots and see what it's telling you.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have a tool or a system for being more innovative?
No, we don't. Or I don't, anyway. Because I think when you're in a startup, it is such a roller coaster, and where you need to innovate changes frequently over time. And so I think having, you know, having a specific way of going about it, or a specific process that you use, at least it feels for me that it doesn't work so well. You know, I'd almost rather just confront each thing or confront each idea and say, all right, what's the best way to approach that?
Yeah. So case by case basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. What's the best way, you know, to keep a project or a client on track?
Oh, good Lord. I wish I wish I could come up with a better way of doing that. I mentioned before that half the process of the sale is being there. The more often you're in front of the customer, the better off both of you will be. The fact that you're showing up means that you care. If the visit is planned, you've got some things you want to cover. It helps keep you on track. It helps keep them on track. So I would say, if anything, in this sort of early stage company, that might well be the simplest and the best tool you can use.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think that's a philosophy that you kind of pushed very hard at Roman Haas, as I remember. So what do you think is the number one thing you can do to differentiate yourself?
That's a great question as well. You know, talking about for Lehigh in particular, I think it's to, now that we've developed our sort of image as a technology leader, you know, as somebody who knows what the product is that they have and knows how to use it, I think protecting that position is probably the single most important thing we can do to create value. There are, of course, many other things, but that's probably the one that is so different from everybody else that's either tried to do this before or is trying to do it now, that we need to make sure we nurture and protect that competency.
So what do you see as the future for you and for Lehigh?
Lots of people ask me that question. Typically in an early stage company, they say, well, what's your exit strategy or what's your investor's exit strategy? And I tell them my answer to that is, if we build a great company, we'll have plenty of exit options.
Yeah.
So let's not even talk about that. Let's talk about how we're going to build a great company.
And you've talked about the plans that you've got on the table at the moment. So that's really exciting. What do you see as the future for the industry, for recycled rubber in general, or this kind of thing in you know, recycling other materials perhaps?
Very positive. You know, I would say that we're in the very early stages of the cradle-to-cradle approach that you mentioned before. It's very hard to recycle a lot of materials. But it's gratifying to see that, you know, even outside of Lehigh, there are lots of people that are trying to figure out how to do that. So I see ourselves at the very early adoption phase of that cycle. I probably won't be around when it's a major part of the chemical world, but the next generation will. You know, I think we're 15, 20, 30 years away from a situation where a large part of what we use every day will have been used once before already.
That's great, and it's a good segue into the competition again. As I said, I'm giving away a copy of the Cradle to Cradle by, and I don't have in front. There it is, William McDonough and Michael Braungart. So Cradle to Cradle, basically talking about continually circulating viable materials so that you know, we're not wasting as much as we do today. So what we'd like you to do to enter that competition today is tell us about a recycle innovation that you're aware of, but perhaps you're doing yourself or you've seen other people doing, and how that is contributing to this cradle to cradle approach. Give us a little bit of a description in the comments below this video, and I'll get Alan to come and have a look at those comments in a few weeks' time and award the prize, if that's okay.
That sounds good.
Yeah, great. So what kind of things do you expect from the Internet of Things?
It's a, that's another very interesting subject these days. There's a good friend of mine who's been a career commercial guy in the startup world, and he is now involved in that Internet of Things market. And you can start to see the first examples of that showing up around us now, right? Smart houses and some of the stuff that goes with that. The consumers love it because it gives them more control over their environment. So I think that's one of the first places that you'll start to see simple things happening, whether it's energy control and savings or whether it's monitoring other key parts of your household. That's going to be the first place to hit, in my view.
And
then, you know, some of the more bigger industrial things will probably follow after that. So, you know, I think well within my working life, you know, my mobile phone is going to be controlling a large portion of what I do every day. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. We've just had solar panels installed on our house, and it's all connected up to the internet, and you can go on the internet and monitor what each panel is doing individually and sort of break it down the time of day. And I've sort of spent a couple of days watching it, and I'm sort of over it now. But my wife comes home every day, and first thing she does is log onto that site and checks it out and looks at the bar charts hour by hour. So, yeah, it's quite fascinating.
I love it.
Yeah. All right, so what's the number one piece of advice you would give any business who wants to be a leader in innovation and in their field?
Yeah, I think the answer to that one is go for it.
Yeah.
You know, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to take a risk. Try it. You can do it.
Yeah. So the Nike approach, just go and do it.
Exactly. Just do it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Great stuff. I love it. So, Alan, this has been fabulous, and really appreciate your time and all the insights you've shared with us today. Where can our audience reach out to you and say thank you?
The easiest place to leave comments is our website, www.lehightechnologies.com.
Yep.
We also have a Facebook page for those of you that are on that too. That's an easy place to leave leave input. So those are probably the two simplest ones.
Okay, and we'll have the links to those places below the video when it's posted.
Yeah.
So finally, Alan, who would you like to see me interview on a future podcast and why?
Yeah, there's I actually had to do a bit of research on that because I wanted to find something that was closer to home for you guys. So there's a professor at the University of Queensland called Professor Marie Smith.
Okay.
And she's obviously got an academic background in the medical arena, but she's had several startups, at least two that I'm aware of, that have been successful in the area of therapeutics.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, she's very heavily involved in pain management, which is, you know, for a lot of chronic conditions in the world now, that's a very important facet for quality of life. And that's, I think, the topic of a latest startup. So I think it'll be a totally different field than some of the others that you've done.
Yeah.
And it's also fairly close to home for you as well.
Yeah. Similar time zone.
Yep.
All right. Well, Marie, look out for an invitation from me in your inbox for a future Innova Buzz podcast. So thank you very much, Alan. It's been fascinating talking to you. It was great to catch up again. And, you know, you've been very generous in your time and sharing your insights with us today on the podcast. I wish you all the best with Lehigh, and I look forward to seeing how things develop, particularly over the next year or two with all the exciting expansion plans that you have in place and that are underway. So thanks very much.
That's great, Jürgen. Thanks very much. And really enjoyed catching up with you as well. And hopefully sometime in the next year, I'll be in Australia.
Okay.
We can catch up with a beer.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. Thanks, right. Alan.
Thanks. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed meeting Alan as much as I enjoyed catching up with him and interviewing him on today's podcast. As you might have gathered, he certainly is carrying on the tradition that he did at Roman Haas, which is to be a great leader, to inspire his people to build a culture of innovation and a culture of service to the customer. He provided some great tips for us today on the podcast. For example, take every opportunity to get in front of your customer, show them that you really care about them and about their success, and of course, about innovation and taking calculated risks in order to actually achieve some innovation. Now, we'd love you to subscribe to this podcast over on iTunes or on Stitcher, because if you do, you'll never miss a future episode. Now, the show notes for this episode are going to be at innovabiz.com.au/AlanBarton. That's ALANBARTON. InnovaBiz.com.au/AlanBarton. All lowercase, no hyphens, no dashes, no underscores. You know the drill by now. So just InnovaBiz/AlanBarton. Now remember to leave your comments underneath the video for a chance to win the prize, which today is a copy of the book Cradle to Cradle by William McDonough and Michael Braungart. Tell us about a recycling innovation that you've done or you've participated in, or perhaps you've seen other people build such a recycling innovation, one that's consistent with the cradle to cradle philosophy. Tell us how that works and give us a little bit of a description in the comments. So if you do that, I'll get Alan to swing by in a few weeks' time and award the prize to the best entry. Now, Alan nominated Professor Marie Smith of Queensland University to be a future guest on our InnovaBuzz podcast. Marie has done some exciting stuff in the medical field, and that'll be an interesting interview. So, Marie, look out in your inbox for an invitation from me to be a guest on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. If you like these podcast episodes, we'd really love you to give us a 5-star review over on iTunes, because that does help in getting us ranked more highly on iTunes, and it does help in spreading these podcasts to a much bigger audience. And I think you'll agree with me that with all the exciting stuff and the inspiring interviews and guests that we've got on this podcast, it really is a shame if we can't get a much bigger audience and share it as far as possible. So give us a 5-star review over on iTunes. That would be really fabulous. And that's all for today. And you know what comes next? Remember, if you don't innovate, you stagnate. So think big, be adventurous, and innovate on.